First morning I have free. Duties, you know. The doctor's wishes come first. Zippy stuck out a hand, shook Cad's lower right hand. A good workout, then a glass of something cool together. Sharpie, I said to myself. Dee Dee and Jacob and I were going to keep you so busy that you won't ever have a free morning. If those classic romances are true, and they seem to be, essentially, in this universe, Barsoomians had never heard of foils and plastrons and masks. A practice workout meant that the loser needed a surgeon or an undertaker. Zebby, you are like hell going to fight for fun. We need you all in one piece. Cad was so overcome that all he could do was grin like a gargoyle and nod. His uncle thanked Zebby for him, then got around to the question he had been quivering to ask, but had to work up his courage.
Captain Zebediah Carter of Virginia.
Tom Tackus hesitated.
You know, I am sure, the hatching name of our warlord.
Surely, Captain John Carter of Virginia, now Jeddak of Jeddax, warlord of Barsoom.
Yes, yes.
Tommy paused.
Carter is an unusual name.
Not in Virginia. You're asking, are we related? Yes, but distant cousins. Had I the Carter family archives at hand, I could show you the concatenation. Let it stand that we both are descended from John Carter the Great, founder of Virginia. But your John Carter is from a cadet line, and family legend has it that this was why he left Virginia to seek fame and fortune elsewhere. As may be, he was gone a long time before we heard of him again. How is the old boy these days? Spry and restless as ever?
I am sure he is, most royal captain, but he is away from Helium on one of his many scientific and exploratory expeditions. The Prince Regent and his consort, Princess Thuvia, attend to state affairs in his absence.
Has something happened to Deja Thoris? Oh, I hope not.
Your imperial cousin is well, sire, but she is pleased to delegate affairs of state to her son. On only formal state occasions does she appear in person. She has dispensed with most protocol until the return of her husband. That is her custom.
Well, I am sorry that Cousin John is away. But that last is pleasing. I dislike stuffy protocol almost as much as the distinguished doctor. Standing for hours watching processions, parties and balls and receptions that bore a fighting man, you know. But I promised my mother that I could bring her any news of Deja Thoris. And now I can do so without Pother and Falderall.
I fancy a private audience can be arranged.
Well, I should think so. Or Mother will send Cousin John a message that will make his ears burn. You know how it is with senior dowagers of a great house. They expect their wishes to be met.
Tom Tackus nodded ruefully.
I know how it is among Tharks. It's the same as Helium.
Tharks? You are from the land of the Tharks?
I was hatched there, sire.
Tackus. Any connection with Tars Tarkus? Tommy looked like a happy gollywog.
My brood uncle of whom I spoke. That's why I must see to the discipline and training of Cad.
I see. I look forward to meeting Tars Tarkus.
Tars Tarkus is general in chief of all imperial forces, red, green, yellow, and black, stationed at the capital. But alas, he is with the warlord. They are well-nigh inseparable, he added proudly.
Zebby sighed. That's the story of my life, Tom Tackus. When the elephants go past, I'm always out for a short beer.
I do not understand, sire.
Just meaning that I'm sorry not to be able to meet your uncle and to gossip with my cousin. I've rattled on too long. We must return. First, however, I must add to the introductions. Did I say that my full name is Captain Zebediah John Carter?
Zebediah John Carter.
Yes, both my cousin and I are named for our illustrious ancestor. I conjecture that my cousin dropped his first name when he left home. Many of us do. I do not, because that would make too many John Carters in Virginia. And one is enough for Barsoom, so I'll continue to be known as Zebediah. A word to the wise friend. But it gives me great pleasure to say that Princess Didi made me her consort, so she is known in Virginia as Milady Zebediah John Carter. And Princess Hilda is Frau Herr Dr. Professor Burroughs, consort of the famous doctor, and Milady Carter, Princess Didi, is daughter of Dr. Burroughs. A family party. Tommy's eyes were growing so round I thought they would pop out of his sleek head.
A royal family party.
No, no, Tom Tackus. Don't think of us that way. A group of scientists traveling together who happen to be related. No protocol, none.
Didi interrupted this horrendous string of lies and half-truths with,
Zebediah, the sun is dropping. We must leave.
Right away, dear. The Princess Didi keeps track of priorities for her illustrious father. Tell me how to find you in Helium.
Just leave word at American Express.
Zebby didn't blink. Fine. See you, Cad, in the Swordmaster's halls. Cower, Catch-Catch-Can. Tom Tackus, my friend, get word to the Empress that I will send in my card soon and await her conveniences. Subject only to the doctor's researches. Cower.
But mighty captain,
Tommy almost wailed. We were interrupted by a crackling voice from the pommel. No, not pommel, as those Thoats were ridden bareback. A girth, like those on Brahma bulls ridden at rodeos, but far more ornate and with several items mounted where a pommel should be.
Businessman to laughing boy, come in.
Tommy looked torn.
Excuse me a short moment, gentle sirs and ladies.
He rushed to his thoat, grazing nearby, reached up.
Laughing boy to businessman, I read you.
Then muttered,
confound these cheap portable wirelesses, never work except when you don't want them.
Can't you find those tourists? You've been gone long enough.
I found them in the Bay of Blood, southwest of the Greater Helium.
The observatory told you that. You haven't found them.
But I have. Their sky chariot is 3 hods west of the Promontory of Tears. Businessman, listen carefully. They are here, in earshot.
Why didn't you say so? Have you signed them up?
No.
Why not? Don't tell me that Thomas Cook beat you to it again. If so, don't bother to come back. And your lazy nephew. Let me talk to Catch-Catch-Can.
You don't understand.
Tommy's lisp was giving him fits. I felt sorry for him.
I understand you've muffed an easy sale.
Tommy broke into Barsoomium. All I caught was John Carter, Deja Thoris, and Zebediah John Carter.
Talk English, you overgrown Derek. You know I can't understand Barsoomian over the wireless.
Tommy sighed.
Poles, Lili Selin Dulumili. Delisi Nolat, Malaralakalis, Rulayalal, Palaralalati, Kulislin Ulof, Walaralal, Alolaralad.
Didi whispered to me,
Dig it, doll baby?
Not a bit. English, not even substitution. Nonsense syllables stuck between letters. The Jolly Green Giant told him who we are, warning his boss to handle with care.
Have you gone crazy? The wireless sputtered.
Businessman, official, urgent. I am not crazy. If I am, you can feed me to Banths. If you are silly enough to muff this one, I'll wager 7-1 that the Empress will have you fed to Banths. By the sacred dugs of Issus, I swear it.
A tense, waiting silence.
Businessman to Laughing Boy, put Catch-Catch-Can on the wireless.
The two giants shifted places. Tommy's Thoet rocked and squealed, but let Catch-Catch-Can stand by him.
Catch's mitt to Businessman, over.
Catch, what the devil is going on? Has Tom lost his mind?
Boss, you had better believe him. It's true.
I heard a sigh right through the horrible static of that Barsoomian walkie-talkie.
Catch, tell me who's in this party. Who and how many, exactly?
Four. Two chieftains, two princesses. The Sky Chariot is a private yacht. Belongs to the head chieftain, the distinguished Dr. Burroughs, greatest scientist in all the starry voids. Commanding his yacht is Captain Zedebiah John Carter of Virginia. His princess...
Captain Zebediah John Carter?
That's what I said. Captain Zebediah John Carter, cousin of the warlord, and Jeddak of Virginia. His consort is the Princess Dee Dee, daughter of the great Dr. Burroughs, and his consort is the Princess Hilda, who almost killed Laughing Boy when she thought he was mistreating Captain Zebediah John Carter.
What did that idiot do? Oh, I'll feed him to Bantz myself.
I'm a sweet, even-tempered person, mostly, but I won't see my friends pushed around. I rushed up to Tommy's Thoet, swarmed up its leather girth, got astride its withers to reach that wireless. The Thoet tossed its head, tried to throw me, but I hung on. Tommy moved fast, put his hand on it, and quieted it. The wireless said,
"Catch, answer me."
"Businessman, shut up. This is the Princess Hilda. It was a natural mistake. And Tom Tackus was a perfect gentleman, which you are not. One more silly word out of you and I'll tell Deja Thoris all about your misbehavior. Is this the way you treat guests? Tom Tackus is under my personal protection. Do you understand that, businessman? Or would you rather be out of business and on the streets? Begging for a crust of bread.
My princess,
I am not your princess. Have you no manners at all? I am Her Highness the Princess Hilda, consort of Dr. Burroughs.
I most humbly crave your pardon, Your Highness.
You simply made another loutish mistake. We will overlook it, but I am warning you, once and only once, that if I hear that you have tried to blame any of this silly foo-for-all on Tom Tackus, it will be not your license that you lose, but your life. The Princess Thuvia's pet banths are always hungry, I hear.
Your Highness, what can I do to make amends?
You can listen to Tom Tackus and take his advice. I have spoken.
Tommy lifted me down with both hands and I went straight into my husband's arms, shaking uncontrollably. Jacob petted me. "There, there, my darling, it's all right." He smiled at me, tilting my face up with a finger under my chin.
"Zeb tells me that you intimidate IRS agents. I believe it."
"Why can't I be a lady like Dee Dee? I don't like fights, they scare me."
"You are a lady like Dee Dee, my only love. She doesn't like to fight either. She's bigger than you are, that's all, and uses different methods. I recall once in Chicago, professional meeting, and Dee Dee was coming back to our hotel alone. Two men. The cops had to send stretchers for them. But you do all right your way."
"Dear Jacob is such a comfort. I've always felt like a midget in a world of giants. But Jacob makes me feel as big as anyone."
Zebby and Dee Dee patted me and congratulated me on what Zebby called a star performance, even for Sharpie. Then he looked at the sun and added,
"Dee Dee, if we don't start at once, we may have to get Hilda to persuade our friends to give us a hitchhike home. I don't fancy being out in this wasteland after dark."
Tommy stopped talking with his boss and turned to us, rubbing all four hands together and grinning.
"All arranged. No protocol, no inspections.
courtesy of the port and keys to the city. Your apartments will be waiting. In the palace, probably. Certainly tomorrow. If that, then tonight, the finest suite in Hilton Interplanetary. Compliments of American Express. I was asked if you each preferred separate quarters. I said that I was sure you would prefer to stay together, one large apartment. Did I do right?
Yes, agreed my husband. Except that tonight we return to our sky chariot. The captain was wondering whether or not your Thoats could carry extra passengers. If so, you could favor us with a ride to our chariot? Our ladies are weary. Poor Tommy was upset again.
But you are expected in the city, sir, distinguished doctor.
Impossible, I'm afraid. We have nothing with us for overnight. No fresh clothing, no toilet articles, no...
Believe me, Dr. Burroughs, all has been anticipated, all will be provided.
But our chariot...
Can it be hurt by night weather, or by animals?
Captain, my husband asked.
No, not by weather, not by animals. But Tom Tackus, how long will it take to reach the city?
This caused a huddle between my husband, Tommy, and Dee Dee. They had trouble matching units. Tommy did not know what a kilometer was, we didn't know what a hod was, and Dee Dee was still uncertain about Barsoom's rotation, the local day. But Dee Dee had Zebby stand by Tommy. Then, using Zebby's height, 194 centimeters, she was able to mark 2 meters, using her shotgun to point the height. Dee Dee has trouble stretching that high. Half that gave a meter, then defining a kilometer was no problem. Tommy knew the decimal system. It turned out that the gates of Greater Helium were about 100 kilometers away. The Thoats could reach there long before local midnight.
Zebby shook his head.
Even if the princesses could endure the ride, it will be cold once the sun sets. Far too cold for ladies, I'm certain. They don't have their furs with them.
My Tommy was undaunted. All was provided, all. Furs and saddlebags. Never mind that there were no saddles. Even an emergency tent. But soon a flyer would be leaving from a city platform. The pilot would know our route and find us before sundown and whisk us to Helium. So Zebby gave in.
Dr. Burroughs, how many doors does your sky chariot have?
2, Zebby answered. Why?
We will protect it.
Tom Tackus opened a belt pouch, took out a package, broke the seal.
The warlord's personal sigil.
American Express is, by special appointment, permitted to use it in emergencies to protect the peace of the realm. I deem this to be such an emergency. With this seal on your doors, no Barsoomian, red, green, yellow, white, black, or piebald, will enter or even touch your chariot. Cad!
Zebby didn't tell him that Gay Deceiver could protect herself against any ordinary intruder. He gravely thanked Tommy. The stripling hurried to us.
Yes, Uncle.
Tear out there and stick the warlord's sign on each door. Then, mind you, catch up before dark. We're leaving now.
I suspect that Tom Tackus, as senior and straw boss, expected to carry Captain Zebediah John Carter and his princess. But I expressed my wishes at once, knowing that Dee Dee would not care. And I did care. Tommy's my pet. I wanted to ride with him, partly to let him know that I wanted to ride with him, but also because I really did. Less than an hour before, he could have broken me in 2 with 1 hand, and no one could have blamed him, as I had been doing my best to blind him. But the dear sweet thing had handled me as gently as possible, while patiently avoiding my attempts to poke out his eyes. Sharpie does not forget such knightly gallantry, and doesn't forget injuries done her either.
Jacob, I would feel safest if I rode between you and Tom Tackus.
Certainly, my dear one, if our host permits, Tom Tackus.
I am deeply honored, Dr. Burroughs.
Tommy put his rifle into a big scabbard on the nigh hind quarter of his thoat, racked his lance on the other side, outrigger gadgets that snapped out of the way if he grabbed for them, mounted his steed, scooted back a little, reached down with four hands, and seated me gently in front of him. Held me with his lower hands, reached past me with his upper hands, and helped Jacob. Once up, he held me with his lower hands, held Jacob under his armpits with his upper hands, and Jacob grabbed the leather girth, making all three of us practically married to the beast. I felt safe. Tommy's solid, muscly tummy made a fine backrest. His hands were better than a seatbelt, stronger, but gentler. From a man, I might have felt that his hands were a touch too intimate, but to a green Barsoomian giant, I would be just sort of a talking doll or cat. He wouldn't take any interest in me that way. Or would he? There was that horrid story about Tal Hadjus. But my Tommy wasn't like that. We wheeled and then we walked and then we trotted and then we fairly flew, the Thoat's pads making no sound on the turf. "Feels swell, doesn't it?" Jacob yelled back over his shoulder. "Surely does, dearest."
20. Zebediah. Dee Dee and I rode with Catch Catch Can while Jake and Hilda were mounted with Laughing Boy, Tom Takas, our worried host. Hilda was sandwiched between Jake and Tom, unable to fall off. I suggested the arrangement to Dee Dee, who vetoed it.
"Zebediah, only if you insist. I'd like to sit in front so that I can see the sights. I couldn't see around your shoulders, but you can see over my head, can't you?"
"Well enough, and I'm not driving. Catch Catch can certainly see over mine. You won't fall off? No stirrups?"
"My captain, I promise to hang on to this belly band with at least one hand every second, but if you're afraid I'll fall off, you can hold me around the waist."
"Any excuse to hold my princess around the waist is a good one, and hanging on to your waist will keep me from falling off. I can't reach the girth strap."
"Oh, I wasn't being considerate. I can't fall off if I hang on to your belt. Let's swap places."
Dee Dee has never learned how to be inconsiderate. She automatically gives the other fellow the biggest piece of pie. "No siree, ma'am, you picked it. I won't swap." Turned out I was in no danger of falling. Catch Catch Can held me gently but firmly with his lower hands. I feel certain that he felt responsible for valuable cargo. If we had taken a tumble, he would have joined the Foreign Legion or its Barsoomian opposite number. I had examined all three giants to be sure that I could call them by name later. Might want to run for alderman someday. Not easy with green men, like peas in a pod or sheep in a mob. But forget species resemblance, concentrate on details, and each is as distinctly individual as you or I. Cad was no problem. Just call any youngster with his left tusk broken off 3 centimeters above the lip, Cad. Then see if he answers. Tom Takas was already a distinct personality. I wouldn't forget him. Catch Catch Can had had little to say, no time to get acquainted. I could feel his washboard belly against my back, could not see him. I concentrated on visualizing him. 5 meters tall, I thought, a head taller than Tom Takas, broad-shouldered, heavily muscled, moved like a cat, and Heidelberg face all over his body. I doubt that I could have placed the flat of my hand on him anywhere without touching scar tissue. Tom Takas had 6 scars, Catch Catch Can had 10 times as many. That and a world-weary aura made me guess that he was much older than Tom Takas, yet Tom Takas had been in charge. Why? Let's find out. Indirectly. Thoats have a smooth gait. They are so massive that they are slow to get underway. For the same reason, they can't turn quickly. But once they reach cruising speed, 30 knots, I would say, they are almost billiard table steady and can keep it up for hours. I think their many legs smooth out chuck holes. All a rider feels is a pleasant surge, more a vibration than a tiring motion. Their gait is noiseless on turf, almost so, I learned later, on pavement. A 30-knot wind does not prevent conversation, or residents of Wyoming would have been forced into sign language generations ago. Dee Dee wanted to see the scenery. But when you've seen one dead sea bottom, you've seen them all. Endless stretches of yellow-orange turf. Not even a jackrabbit. Once we rounded that promontory, the bay opened out. In 20 minutes, the hills, or shoreline, were almost too distant to see. Catch-catch-can, may I ask a question about yourself?
Captain Zebediah John Carter may ask whatever he pleases.
Catch-catch-can spoke English slowly and with care, with occasional errors in syntax and usage. It seemed to me that he was still translating, other than with phrases he used often. So I spoke slowly and tried to avoid unusual idiom. Catch-catch-can, I heard Tom Takis say that you are survivor of 15 games in arena at Warhoons. I thought that my cousin John, the warlord, had put a stop to arena games.
Captain Zed Zeb.
Captain is enough, I cut in. My name is too long to repeat with each remark.
Thank you, Captain. My answer to your question be both yes and no. The red men never followed arena custom, or not for many cycles of cycles. Yellow men I know little about. Green men, our customs vary from horde to horde. General-in-chief Tars Tarkis abolished games among Tharks. The warlord's order, given from the throne and sealed with his hand, forbade everywhere in use of the games of prisoners captured in battle. He did not abolish the games. Men convicted of crimes and sentenced to die could choose the arena or choose to have their cases placed on the pedestal of truth before the throne of righteousness in the temple of reward in Greater Helium. Some prisoners choose arena for quick death fighting or the small hope of eventually winning freedom. Some choose to wait in the dungeons until the warlord's judges of truth review their cases, then die dishonorably or live on in the dungeons for a number of cycles set by the judges, or, seldom, be set free with honor restored. But by your cousin's decree, no woman, green, red, or other color, could be sent to the arena. The ignoble practice of staining the sand with blood of women to amuse the crowd has ended throughout Barsoom. Or so I believe.
Catch-catch-can's slow speech stopped. I thought the subject was ended and was wondering what horrendous crime the big fellow could have committed that had forced him to fight 15 times in the arena rather than trust this case to the appellate court. No, he was gathering his thoughts and arranging them in English.
Convicted criminals willing to roll dice with Isis in the arena were few. The crowds grew bored and royal revenues decreased. But we have a saying, where there is a market willing to buy, there are sellers willing to sell. Do earthlings have that saying? May I ask?
Some say that, or something very like it. I thought about endless governmental attempts to deny this truism, and the black markets that always resulted, but I had no wish to advertise in Barsoom the follies of my native planet.
I became a seller. I was hatched.
The big fellow stopped.
I regret. I am not making hospitality to board the captain and his princess. My life has been a dullness.
Go on, said Dee Dee. You aren't boring us. We are strangers in a strange land. What is dull to you is new and exciting to us.
The princess speaks truth, Catch-catch-can.
I do, Catch-catch-can. If you don't tell us how you got from your hatching to the arena and from there to American Express, I'm going to get off this Thoat and walk. By the way, what's his name or her name? Is this Thoat a mare or a stallion?
Dee Dee had gone outside Catch-catch-can's English vocabulary. He fumbled and tried to apologize. I explained that Didi wanted to know the sex of the beast, male or female, and had to find ways to force our limited mutual vocabulary to fit even this simple question.
"She is she," answered Catch-Catch-Can.
"What is her name?" I continued.
"Thoats cannot have names. They have no speech. I send thoughts to her. She is blank."
I got nothing but the beast squealed like a canary, an oddly musical sound to come from such a mass. But Didi leaned back, twisted her face to mine, and whispered,
"If I were a lady, I would blush. What powerful emotion."
"Come again."
"The sentiment, fully expressed, sometimes ends, if she could only cook. Don't misunderstand me, it's platonic, as well as mechanically impossible, but warmly platonic, and strong, and mutual. Great empathy between them."
"Didi, do you hear thoughts? Telepathic?" Since I am not, I wasn't sure whether to be worried or pleased at the notion.
"Huh? Heavens, no, but I sometimes feel emotions. This time I did, and it warmed me clear to my belly button. Such beautiful rapport. They can't be lonely, they have each other."
Didi raised her voice to buck the wind and said,
"Catch-Catch-Can, since we earthlings cannot send thoughts to her, may I suggest a name for her? Cannot cook."
"But princess, a female does not have two names."
"My cousin-in-law, Deja Thoris, has two names."
"But she is empress. Blank is a Thoat."
"Animals may have names and should have names. Our cousin, the warlord, has a callet named Wula. Do I speak truth?"
"I proposed but one name, suggested to me by your name. Canna Cook. Catch, Catch Can and Canna Cook. Do they not sound well together?" Our big friend answered with obvious pleasure.
"Catch, Catch Can and Canna Cook."
Again, that canary clear squeal.
"Princess, this has your blessing? May I call her that?"
"Would you like Deja Thoris to publish a proclamation?"
"No, no, no. I could not presume. But your blessing would make it lawful."
"The Princess Didi blesses your Thoat with the name Canna Cook."
The Thoat repeated the canary song.
"I have spoken,"
Didi added.
"She already knows her name. You try it, darling."
I doubted, but tried it. "Canna Cook." Our mount again uttered the shrill song.
"Goody!"
Didi started clapping. "Damn it, hang on."
"Sorry, dearest, I got excited."
She grabbed the girth strap and added,
"Catch, Catch Can, you try it. Call her by name."
"Canna Cook."
The Thoat gave out the same three notes. Our big friend yelled in excitement and repeated it,
"Canna Cook,"
and was answered. The green giant could hardly contain himself.
Thank you, princess. Canna Cook.
Canna Cook echoed him. Didi can make friends with anyone, man or beast. But now she muttered,
"I'm being bombarded by both their emotions and getting too excited myself, and this is neither the time nor the place. Help me change the subject."
"Sure thing. I'm too tired anyhow."
"Husband, the conventional ploy is, I have a headache, dear, but I don't have headaches."
"Get the leer out of your voice, wench. Catch, Catch Can, you started a sentence. I was hatched and broke off."
"Yes, Captain. I was hatched many cycles ago in a small horde that lay between Land of Tharks and Land of Warhoons. This was long before the warlord put an end to senseless wars and fruitless battles. We were ground as between millstones until our city was destroyed, our incubator wrecked, our Jed killed, our people dead or scattered. Many times more dead than scattered, for we were fierce in battle and never surrendered, knowing what miserable fate awaited prisoners of Thark or Warhoon. Our own women killed our badly wounded and killed themselves rather than become prisoners. So our very name is forgotten. We are no more." That final battle was not the first time that Kanakuk saved my life, nor the last time. I was sore wounded, and Kanakuk, sensing that I could not defend myself, fled the field of battle at her greatest speed, much faster than we are now going. I managed, I know not how, to cling to the leather. She took me to a small oasis not on traveled routes. A plant is, sap is drink, pulp is food. I lived. I grew strong. Time passed. I searched for my brood horde, found never. Kanakuk.
Kiss me. I'll pinch you instead. Ouch, brute. I mean, Captain Brute, sir.
Hatched the very day I was hatched and given to me by my brood father to raise and train. We now had only each other. I became, the word is Panthan, and means a warrior without a chief, seeking work wherever he finds it. For many cycles I fought for Jed after Jed, always moving on after winning one duel and avoiding duels when possible.
Why? Asked Didi. I mean, why did you move on? You must have won every duel. You are here, you are alive. Wouldn't it have saved trouble to stay with one horde?
Catch-Catch-Can was silent so long that I thought Didi had offended him. I should have known better. It was no longer possible for Didi to offend this giant, no matter what she said or did, and her immunity had nothing to do with her status as princess, deriving from the most brassy lies I had ever told. Didi had named Kanakuk and made it official, with a harmless fib that matched my lies. Our friend now owned, or was owned by, the relationship was reciprocal, the only Thoat in Barsoom having a name. Didi could do no wrong.
Not easy to explain. Ancient custom, princess. Winner of duel always challenged again and again, until day comes when Jed fights winner to stop losing warriors and to get rid of rival. I had no wish to be Jed. I moved on. I moved on. I moved on. Times change. Your cousin, the warlord, makes profession of Panthan have little use. I speak no treason, I speak history. My lance and my sword are pledged to warlord until Issus takes me. No longer Panthan, citizen. Helium is my city, the warlord's banner, my banner. My skin is green, but by imperial decree I am red. Am I understood? Better red than dead, if the captain says so,
Catch-Catch-Can said dubiously.
But I did not pledge to the warlord to escape death. First, was not needful. Second, my life is of little value. I would have made the pilgrimage before Captain John Carter of Virginia came to teach us new customs, were not Kanakuk my responsibility. Once, many cycles ago, I tried to get her to join a herd of wild Thoats. I removed her leathers and ordered her to leave me and join her own kind. She would not obey. The only time she has ever refused in both our lives. So I am not free to die while she needs me. Am I making a true understanding? He added anxiously. I answered, soberly. Be certain of it, our friend. We of Earth have a similar custom followed by all honorable men and women. Often, a man or woman forces himself to stay alive when his body needs to die, because a debt remains unpaid. Is that what you are saying?
The captain speaks truth.
You could not die with honor while Kanakuk lived and needed you. We understand it, and beings who do not live by this rule are less than animals. Trash. So Kanakuk and Catch-Catch-Can both lived by this rule. Then hard times came knocking at the door. What then?
Captain, my English are few. Your pardon?
No, I beg your pardon, our friend. I think you said that there were no jobs for your profession. Panthan.
Is truth, Captain. No Jed willing to hire my lance, but arena of warhoons needed blood.
We went there. Kanakuk and I apprenticed to a free gamesman, a veteran warrior paying fee to join their guild by indentures. Do I make understanding? I sold me. I did not sell Kanakuk.
Golly Moses, would you sell me, Zebediah?
Not cheaply. I have too much invested in you. Wait till the price is right. Then, I added, don't stick out your tongue, you'll get it windburned. We understand you, Catch-Catch-Can. What does an apprentice do? Serves his master, attends his thoat, cares for his weapons and his leather, massages him before games, dresses his wounds after, keeps master in practice between games, taking care not to wound him, sleeps in the stables and eats what his master gives him, and waits.
Waits for what? Didi asked.
Whatever comes, princess. His master may die on the sand, thus ending indenture. A freed apprentice may sell himself again, or may choose the arena when next his dead master would have foughten. But in my case, the game's master watched me at practice, bought my indenture from my master, and entered me in the lists, and in my first game pitted me against my former master.
Catch-Catch-Can paused.
I killed him. I gained no joy in the killing. I knew his weak points, he did not know mine, since it is not proper for apprentice to wound master. So I won his weapons and his thoat, kept what I needed, sold his thoat, and my name was posted for games thereafter. I fought.
Pushed by curiosity, I asked a snoopy question. Catch-Catch-Can, what's it like being a professional gladiator? I felt him shrug.
It's a living.
Shut my mouth. But apparently the question was not offensive, for he continued, a dull living most time, but comfortable. One eats well, too well, perhaps. Time between games is long, and a warrior can grow fat and soft and slow if he eats too much and trains not enough. Thus end most gladiators, and none but Mother Isis knows whether they sought to sleep in her arms or arrived there through carelessness and sloth.
He shrugged again.
I was not careless. Clearly you were not, I answered with no sarcasm. You won 15 bouts.
I added quietly to Didi, what are the odds?
32,768 against, assuming that each bout was evenly matched.
Clearly not true, I think. Catch-Catch-Can again took time to arrange his thoughts.
Pardon me, noble captain. Not easy for me to speak true in your tongue. Games 4 times each cycle, or more, or less. 10 days mark 1 game.
Didi whispered,
150 days of fighting. I can't even guess at the odds. Men are not dice.
Catch-Catch-Can, you fought every day? 15 games, each 10 days long? No, no, captain. At first, yes, and many ways, against men, on foot, against mounted men, Kanakuk and I, against wild Kalits, against Banths, but the game's master is ordered by the Jed to wait each bout evenly, for the crowds will not wager on a known outcome. A man on foot is not pitted against a Banth. The Banth would win, and Jed would order the game's master himself to fight the Banth next, on foot. A warrior who wins many times will be pitted only against other seasoned warriors, not against wild animals, not against beginning warriors. At first I fought daily each 10-day game. Then I fought fewer times for higher stakes. During my last cycle in the games, I fought only 7 bouts, all against other seasoned survivors.
So once again you ran out of work?
No, captain, I wearied. I grew tired of useless killing. My ancestors would have thought me mad, disowned me. But each new bout became simply a chore to finish quickly, so that I could feed Kanakuk, bathe myself, curl up in my silks against her, and sleep. I removed my name from the lists, paying the game's master his due, and enrolled in the Berlitz School for English.
21. Jake. Both Hilda and I enjoyed that Thoat back ride with Tom Takas. The scenery was monotonous, but the ride had the carefree feeling of Sunday afternoon drives of my childhood, when people were content to drive on the ground, instead of zipping across several states without time for scenery, monotonous or otherwise. Best of all, here was no smog, no fumes, no Sunday drivers, no traffic cops, and no need for them. The motion of a Thoat is remarkably smooth, no danger of being jounced off, no danger of any sort that I could see. Once, when hills closed in near the end of the ride, Tom Takas pointed out what he said was a wild banth on the skyline. But that gave only the tiniest thrill of danger, as the speck he pointed out could have been anything. I think the green Barsoomians have better distance vision than we have. Reasonable, since they live in vast vistas like the plains Amerindians of our history. My distance vision is 20/20. I wear bifocals, but the upper lenses are zero prescription. I think Tom Takas must have 40/20 for distance, eagle's eye. He assured us that banths never came close to mounted thoats in daylight, although they preyed on wild thoats. They had learned to be wary of rifles. Tom Takas was a cultured gentleman, and a soldier, and a courier for tourists, both from Earth and from distant parts of Barsoom. I wondered aloud how he combined the professions. Simple. All Barsoomians were soldiers, from warlord to simplest peasant. But save for the few staff and housekeeping jobs and certain technicians of their air navy, being in the armed forces was not a livelihood. It is much like the Swiss citizen soldiery, a civic duty but not usually a trade. Exception. Slaves are not soldiers. But the warlord had abolished hereditary serfdom and the Barsoomian word translated as slave. I am sure that my daughter, Diti, a nitpicker in such matters, would construe indentured servant as the maximum legal contract wherever the writ of the warlord was 20 cycles. However, if I understood what I was told, 20 cycles is 38 years, Earth time, and that amounts to slavery in my eyes. It may not seem so to Barsoomians with natural lifespans so long that death by violence or accident is enormously more frequent than death by old age. Tom Takas assured me that daughters of peasant families swarmed into the capital, eager to list themselves for the auction block at maximum indenture, so numerous that they are a public nuisance. Men were less a problem. Commerce needed muscles in this society. Tom Takas held rank equivalent to captain on the staff of the Thark regiment stationed at the capital. He described Catch-Catch-Can as best Barsoomian obscenity, sergeant major and hand weapons instructor in the whole obscenity-profanity planet Barsoom. Then apologized abjectly for having let his enthusiasm cause him to lapse into barracks language in Princess Hilda's presence. We both assured him that idioms in a language not known to us could not possibly offend Hilda's refined feelings. Then my playful little bride offered to teach him the full gamut of lurid English improprieties. If Tommy Tucker would tutor her in Barsoomian gutter idioms, barracks talk, etc. Tom Takas was shocked, and tried not to show it while also trying gracefully to refuse without actually saying no to a request from a princess. "Tell him, doctor," Hilda urged while pinching me out of our courier's sight. "Reassure him as to my scientific interest." I attempted one of Zeb's flights of fancy, helped by the fact that our giant friend could not see my face. "Tom Takas, my friend, the princess is a linguistic scientist, widely known as the top authority on comparative vulgar and improper idiom among 9 representative terrestrial languages. She was awarded the Medal of Mark Twain with Diamond Cluster for this, as well as the Order of Sir Richard Burton. You would greatly assist my anthropological researches on this planet were you to grant her request. Whether you wish to learn what she can teach you of this science is, of course, your choice. Is English your principal interest, or do you know other terrestrial language? Once convinced that Hilda's interest was scientific, Tom Takas eagerly agreed and accepted the offer of a chance to learn improper English, English being the only non-Barsoomian tongue he knew. It appears that tourists had already left him in doubt as to how well he knew English. His tutor had been an Englishman, sent down from Oxford, and, I surmise, shipped to Barsoom to get him out of sight. Tom Takas knew some British idioms and words not meant for the parlor, but had not been warned by his tutor. Hilda agreed to set him straight. They solemnly shook hands on the bargain, a terrestrial custom he knew. The reddened sun was touching the horizon when the flyer found us. I had worried toward the end and tried not to show it. Banths did not worry me, but the temperature was dropping. Despite reassurances about furs and about the certainty of the flyer finding us, I thought it likely that we would at least have frostbitten hands and feet if anything went wrong. But this time we escaped Murphy's Law. The flyer settled beside us while it was still light but getting dark. Both women were distressed at leaving our new friends to ride home in the dark and cold, but Tom Takas assured us that riding all night was no hardship to them or their mounts, and this was no all-night march, but an easy jaunt about twice the distance we had covered. We had to accept their assurances. It was Hobson's choice, as the flyer was too small to carry the 3 giants. Cad had joined up in mid-march. Even if the Thoats had been turned loose to go home alone. Thoats can do this just as dogs and horses can. After Tom Takas lifted me down, Hilda stood up on our Thoat, turned, reached high, and grabbed Tom Takas by his tusks. "Tommy Tucker, you go straight home, you hear me? And be careful." Then she jumped, floated down. My daughter was saying goodnight to Catch Catchcan while standing at the head of his Thoat as she did so and scratching the ugly beast's snout. Far from resenting it, the monster was uttering squeals that seemed to suggest pleasure. Didi called out, "Thanks, Catch Catchcan. We'll see you soon," turned to leave. The beast stretched its neck, bumped her shoulder, almost knocking her down. Didi was not hurt, did not mind it. She caught her balance, turned again, petted it, saying, "Kennacook, not so hard, dear. Didi will come see you, I promise." The beast trilled like a bird. My son-in-law and I are most fortunate. I have little talent with people. Zeb is better at it. Nevertheless, he keeps most people at arm's length by his easy banter. But my daughter and my beloved wife can make friends with anyone, anywhere, anytime, man or beast. Hilda has the added talent of being able to spank anyone who annoys her. Didi is more inclined to walk away. The Barsoomian flyer looked more like a boat than an aircraft. No apparent means of propulsion or control. Bow and stern looked alike, and the top was decked over. This deck was covered by a transparent canopy that lifted as the hull touched down. The pilot got out. A handsome young-looking red man, dressed in military harness, sword at side, and the sigil of the warlord on his chest ornament. He smiled at us, said, "Cower!" then spoke to Tom Takas in rapid-fire Barsoomian. Tom Takas listened, then spoke. This officer is personal pilot to the Princess Thuvia, consort of the regent. His name is Jopar Falloum. The pilot grinned. Call me Joe. And he does not speak your language other than that one phrase, one you may take literally. His rank is Padwar, but he having invited you to use his English nickname, I am sure that he would feel reprimanded if you addressed him by rank. Of course you may, if you wish. It is correct protocol. I am not advising you not to do so. He knows who you are and where to take you. To the palace, not to the Hilton, I am happy to learn. Dr. Burroughs, you ordered no protocol. May I introduce your pilot to you? Or is that against your wishes? Eh? Introduce us all, certainly. I began to wonder just how far no protocol went. A modicum of ritual smooths relations, but one must know the ritual. Thank you, Doctor. You are gracious. The Princess Hilda, allow me to present your servant, Jopar Falloum. Cower, Joe, my darling gave him her sunniest smile. Joe answered, Cower, Barsoomian title, Hilda, while bowing deeply. The honorific I did not catch then, but it is one used for a Barsoomian woman royal by birth or marriage, so princess will do. The same word with possessive inflection has a different meaning and must be used with great care. The nuances of the Barsoomian language are so complex that it is safer to speak English. None of the couriers employed by American Express or Thomas Cook is terrestrial human. Joe added a sentence as he straightened up. What did he say? Demanded Hilda. A compliment to you, Princess. It does not translate easily. You can try, can't you? Princess Hilda. A literal translation would distort the true meaning deplorably. Tom Takas's lisp had taken over strongly, a sure sign that he was embarrassed. I told Hilda to drop it. She seemed about to balk, then shrugged and smiled. Okay, Tommy Tucker. But remember it for our first language session. He agreed. Then Titi got the same routine. She said, Tommy, if that's another you don't want to translate, just save it up and tell Hilda later. It was. For me and for Zeb, the routine was simpler. Joe answered us with, Cower, Dr. Burroughs, and Cower, Captain Zebediah John Carter, each with a Barsoomian open-handed salute, which we imitated. We boarded then, found that we were expected, by Joe showing us, to lie down and each hang on to a looped strap, two of us forward, Didi and Zeb, and my wife and I aft. The deck was padded. We were comfortable. Joe went forward, lay down on his belly. We took off with a surge. 20 minutes later, we landed on the roof of the palace. The canopy swung up. Joe jumped out and offered his forearm to our ladies. We were boxed by a hollow square of swordsmen, each with sword at point and their commander with his held high. Their leather was crusted with sparkling ornaments. No protocol. No protocol. A man not of the guard and armed only with a sword was standing where we debarked. Dr. Burroughs? I am he. Cower. Cower, learned doctor. I am Navok, Barsoomian word. Mayor of the palace, Major Domo to the regent. The regent sends greetings to you and to his senior cousin, Captain Zebediah John Carter, and his respects to your consorts, the Princess Hilda and the Princess Titi. It is his understanding that you prefer no formality. But if such be not the case, he directs me to call out the guard and to inform him post-haste so that the regent and his consort may hurry here to greet you. So this was not the guard. Zeb moved in quickly, spoke for me. Please tell my young cousin that our message reached him correctly. The doctor wishes no fuss to be made over his visit. He is here to pursue his researches, not to have his time taken up with ceremonies. Tonight we are weary. Tomorrow will be soon enough for informal greetings, or so it seems to me. Certainly, Captain Zebediah John Carter of Virginia. Navok spoke more slowly now. I think his opening speech had been memorized. His grammar remained perfect and his accent precise, with a flavor of the Old Dominion. The doctor's wishes will be met, and your suggestion will be conveyed to the regent. Good. It seems to me these watchmen could return to their posts. We appreciate the salute, but there is no need to continue it. Yes, Captain. The palace boss tossed a word over his shoulder. The officer of the watch, sergeant of the guard, brought his blade down smartly. The hollow square broke, and they trotted away in all directions. It was a very big roof. But a squad remained and stationed themselves around us. No protocol? Navok continued. I bring greetings also from Tardos Mors, Jeddak of Helium, Mors Kajak, Jed of Lesser Helium, but by wireless. They are not in residence. Deja Thoris, granddaughter of Tardos Mors, daughter of Mors Kajak, princess of Helium, consort of the warlord, mother of the regent, empress, sends her warmest greetings to Hilda, princess of Logan, and to Diti, princess of Virginia, and looks forward to greeting them in person. Meanwhile, she has sent a surrogate to ensure that your slightest wish will be met. I am under the same orders. Tell any servant, any watchman, and I will come at once, night or day. I have spoken. Tira! From out of the shadows, a woman appeared, almost running, and prostrated herself in front of Hilda and Diti, forehead and hands to the landing platform, knees tucked under her. She moved so quickly that I did not get a good look at her, just a glimpse that told me that she was shapely and bare as an egg. No ornaments, not even a dagger at belt or a ring on her fingers. Hilda squatted down, touched her arm. Dear, don't do that. Stand up. Tira flowed to her feet. Yes, she was shapely. But in Helium, as in Charleston, South Carolina, an unsightly female is hard to find, with the difference that the red women of Barsoom look as young as co-eds for so very long that some violent death usually catches up with them before entropy does. A blessing or a curse? Tira said softly, "The princess is most gracious." She stopped, then added, "May I guide you to your apartments?" Her English had a lilt to it, as if she had come from Middle Sweden near Uppsala. "The sooner the better, dear." "Tira, is it?" "Chilly up here at night." Chilly indeed, but not as cold as I had expected. The landing platform felt warm to my bare feet. Radiant heating? "Come this way, please." The remaining squad formed around us. I turned to say goodnight to Joe and to Navok. Both had vanished. We moved off, halted at a spot that seemed not to be marked. It dropped under us. Zeb steadied my elbow. Just a lift, and one that immediately acquired high guard sides. The palace and all of Barsoom that we saw was not difficult to cope with, if you were used to it. Imagine a Barsoomian in Manhattan's subways and you'll have the idea. A sophisticate is a person who knows where the light switch is. In Helium, we rarely knew where the light switch is or anything else. So Tira realized, or had been told, that palace contained hundreds of people, five of them fluent in English. Three of the five were royal. One was the boss's flunky, Navok. One was a slave, Tira. Okay, indentured. But I insist that an indenture of almost 40 Earth years is slavery. Tira, who spoke English so well that she could think in it and knew quite a bit of slang, referred to herself as a slave. Anyone in the palace who wore no ornaments and no weapons was a slave. I might as well spend the 10 minutes it took us to reach our apartments in trying to explain Tira, as the trip was monotonous. But we could not have made it alone. Every archway, every door had armed guards. We were challenged throughout our passage, but never slowed down as the petty officer in charge of our escort sang out to each challenge, whereupon the guards we passed shifted instantly to sword salute, Barsoomian style. Tira called herself a slave as cheerfully as my daughter might answer, "I'm a computer software specialist." Tira did not feel oppressed. She was a success and proud of it. Her parents were minor shopkeepers in Lesser Helium. She was still learning to read and write Barsoomian, although she had spoken it almost from hatching. But she spoke fluent grammatical English, read it as easily, and wrote it in penmanship far better than mine. How? A planned and successful strategy. Her prospects had been negligible. No education, and she worked without pay for her parents. But she saved her coins, and don't ask me how she got them. I refrain from asking. She used her savings to learn English at Berlitz Night School in Lesser Helium, studying under an expatriate couple from Minneapolis, and studied hard. Learning a language does not mean passing examinations, although most students and instructors seem to think so. Learning a language means being possessed by a drive to master that language until one uses it as easily as one's native tongue. I've never had that drive, although I read the language is useful to mathematicians, 5, and can get by orally in 3, macerating accent and syntax. Tira had the drive. She mastered English. She could then have picked from many good jobs. Travel Bureau, Hilton Interplanetary, export-import firms. But she had set her sights higher. She got word, bribery probably, to the palace that a red woman who spoke excellent English offered herself for sale, but not on the auction block. Private sale. Then she waited. Navok interviewed her, offered her a good price. She thanked him and turned it down. A 10 day later, a palace guard was sent to fetch her. The Princess Thuvia wanted to inspect this oddity. Thuvia bought her as a present for her mother-in-law, Deja Thoris. We came to large doors flanked by guards. They saluted. We went through, and our escort remained outside while Tira came in. The great doors closed. We went on through a large foyer into a comfy living room, about 4 times as big as Hilda's ballroom, and lavish enough for Mad King Ludwig. 8. Count 'em. 8 red females were lined upon the padded floor in that same full submission Tira had offered us. Our slaves on loan, 2 for each of us. Hilda and Diti at once tried to put a stop to it, without success. Tira said, Milady's princesses, they know no English. That is why I am here. Then you tell them, said Didi. Teera spoke. The eight stood up, waited. Didi added, now tell them they are not to do that again, not with us, not with any of us. I will tell them, Teera agreed, but I am not sure they will understand. They have been carefully trained. They will think that you are displeased with them. Didi looked frustrated. My darling took over. Teera, do you know what a curtsy is? I think I know, Princess Hilda, but doesn't it require those floor-length ornaments worn by earthling ladies? No one told her that long skirts had become scarce on Earth. Then I recalled that I had no notion of what women were wearing on Earth 10. Not at all, Didi answered. Like this. She dropped her right foot behind her, bobbed down with her left knee, spine erect. Try it. Teera tried it. No, Didi corrected. Not quite. Your right toe barely touches with all your weight on your left leg. She did it slowly. Like that, but quicker. Now try again. Teera curtsied correctly. That's it. There is another sort for long skirts, but it is used in dancing. This curtsy is the correct way for a domestic servant to salute her mistress or master or guest on Earth. Prostration all the way to the floor may be correct for Helium, but never for Virginia or for Logan. Never. It offends us. Please explain this to them. Then teach them proper manners for serving earthlings. Go ahead. You did it beautifully. Teera dimples when she smiles. Her talk to the eight slave girls. Girls? The one who looked 16 may have been a century old. Teera's explanation drew surprise, doubt, beginning comprehension, acceptance, in that order. Then we had a chorus line by the numbers. 1, 2, 3. Down, hold, up. A beautiful sight. All had red skins, black hair on their heads, no body hair worth mentioning, and any of them would have placed in the finals in any beauty contest on Earth. But their skin colors ran from copper to mahogany. They ranged in height from as short as my beloved to slightly taller than my daughter, from willowy slender to pleasantly plump. One little girl stumbled, her lip trembled. Didi quickly moved in beside her, placed a firm arm around her waist, did it with her, smiling at her. Hilda moved in on another one, then moved on to a third, then watched. That's enough, Teera, she decided. They all have it perfectly. Stop them. Didi squeezed little Tremble Lip, smiling now, kissed her quickly. Good girl. You've got it, Teera. Tell her what good girl means. Tremble Chin dimples too, but also blushes from warm copper to deep red. Teera, said my daughter, we don't know their names or what they do. They do whatever you wish, princess. But I must tell them at first. I think that you will find that they learn quickly. Now these three and that one, Teera pointed, are especially skilled as ladies' maids. The other four are experienced in serving gentlemen. However, any of them can do either. If I may suggest it, each of you could pick two as your personal slaves. But you all can expect service from whichever one is nearest, and from me always. I am not here just to translate. The Empress has given me to you for however many cycles you choose to live in the palace, or to travel with you, if such be your pleasure.
Travel on Barsoom, you mean, I said, as we will be traveling elsewhere, to other planets, when I have completed my scientific investigations here.
Tira looked interested but not daunted. The Jadara placed no restriction, Dr. Burroughs. I am your slave until such time as it pleases your fancy to give me back. She looked at me thoughtfully. Travel is broadening, I have heard. I have never been outside the gates of the twin cities of Helium. We had to make choices. Tira had strongly implied that we were expected to do so. But no one was willing to risk hurting the feelings of any of them. One of the saddest things in childhood is being picked last in choosing up sides, and these grown women felt childlike to me in their vulnerability, even though the youngest might be older than I. My daughter solved it by lottery with no hurt feelings. Two maids to Hilda, two to her, with the valets split between me and Zeb. My two were Kissa and Tika, the latter being Tremble Chin, whose chin never trembled again. Impossible to be stern with such willingness to please, even when mistakes were made through lack of common language and background. At Hilda's suggestion, Tira took us on a tour of our apartment, a parade of threes, as Tika and Kissa placed themselves one on each side of me, as did the other six, with my wife, my daughter, and Zeb. But it was not a column of three, as no passage was so narrow as not to allow nine people abreast had we wished. Instead, we milled around. Diti was prone to dart off to the side to look at something, pursued by two wood nymphs, then call to Hilda or all of us to come see too. In addition to a large foyer and that enormous living room, about 6 meters to the ornate ceiling and broad and wide in proportion, there were four large sleeping rooms, no beds. The floors were pleasantly soft firm, with sleeping silks, cushions, and furs in colorful heaps. The corridors of the palace had appeared to be paved in marble, but all floors in our apartment were soft to the feet. Sleeping rooms were more deeply padded. There was a banquet hall with a long, low table, no chairs, but many cushions. I saw no chairs anywhere, but there were many places suitable for sitting. Alcoves, benches that were integral with walls, and something like love seats. The apartment had only one bath, but the tub was an oval pool flush with the floor and 20 meters long. It was not a bathroom in the American idiomatic sense. Instead, every room had at least one powder room, but with fixtures so unlike ours that I had to puzzle them out, being, I confess, too shy to ask Tira. But I was not left in ignorance. Diti poked into everything, asked questions, and the word filtered to us males. I was pleased to see also a small dining room. It opened on a balcony, as did all major rooms. The balcony hung over an inner garden, but we could see little, it being night, and too chilly to be outdoors. Of greater interest was the lavish buffet in that refectory. My daughter said, "Golly, that looks good. I had been intending to bathe before asking about food, but now I'm torn. Pop, what do you think?"
"You're married now, ask your husband."
"Zeb just tells me to make up my own mind." Tira said, "If I may suggest, Princess Diti, there is no need to make a choice."
"Explain yourself, Tira, hon."
"Yes, Princess. I have heard and I have read that on Earth it is the custom to eat at certain times, sleep at certain times, bathe at certain times. In Helium, and especially in the palace, there are no customs in such matters save on formal occasions. One eats when one is hungry, sleeps when one is sleepy, bathes when one feels the wish. Not infrequently, hunger and a wish to bathe can occur at the same time. Especially, I have noticed, after traveling.
so one does both.
How? Didi challenged.
It is the happy duty of Larlo and Fig to bathe and feed the princess whenever she wishes. Shall I tell them to do so now?
Zebediah, this is the best hotel I've ever been in. Want to join me? Get soap suds in your soup?
We all joined her, all having the same dilemma. Me, I felt that I should stink of Thoat. Ridiculous, as Thoats do not carry an odor.
Tira gave an order. All 8 slave girls got very busy while we 4 and Tira started back toward the bathing room about 100 meters away.
Zeb muttered something about, all this joint lacks is bicycles.
Tira caught it and said, Captain and Prince, I have seen, I think, pictures of bicycles. 2-wheeled chariots, are they not? It is probable that our artisans can build bicycles from pictures, but not tonight, not that quickly. I can send for a small chariot which you could ride and Wogian Agile could pull.
Zebediah, said my daughter,
if you accept that offer, I am going to take a picture, even though I'll have to run all the way back to Gay Deceiver to pick up the camera.
Sweetheart, you'll have time to run all the way to Snug Harbor. I refused to try a rickshaw, even though the rickshaw man was huskier than I am. I outweigh Agile and Wogi combined.
Tira,
my remark about bicycles was a figure of speech, an inverted compliment.